We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
I find no evidence from the methods of science for the existence of God. And if there is no evidence for the existence of things, then I, as a scientist, conclude that it does not exist.
That's Dr. Paul Boyer, professor of chemistry at UCLA, voicing a common objection raised by atheists. Of course, atheists have become more evangelistic lately. They proselytize through popular book. We call them the new atheists. That's a name that I think they wear proudly. They claim the rational high ground. They said that their view is based upon evidence. Their view for the non-existence of God is more rational, more intellectual, more intelligible to people. And if only people would figure this out and abandon their superstition, then perhaps all of us might be atheists. Are there arguments for the existence of God that do not appeal to divine revelation? Joining us to talk about the existence of God on this Monday afternoon, June the 2nd, Dr. Joshua Pagan. He's founding director of the Institute for Intellectual Formation and Skeptical Inquiry, and he's author of a chapter in the book Making the Case for Christianity. His chapter is titled Defending the Existence of God. Dr. Pagan, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you.
Is the belief in God fundamentally irrational?
Okay, that's a great question. In his Mere Christianity, C.S. Lewis said, "Now faith is the art of holding on to things your reason has once accepted in spite of your changing moods." Lewis correctly observed that Christian belief is a reasonable trust in the existence of God and the truth claims of Scripture. Christian belief is reasonable insofar as it's grounded in sound arguments and evidence. In other words, there are really good reasons for us to believe. Now, that having been said, a number of contemporary Christian philosophers, especially in the Reformed tradition, have asserted belief in God as properly basic, which is to say, belief in God doesn't need to be inferred from arguments and evidence in order to be reasonable. Rather, it is simply part of our native intellectual endowment. It's produced by our properly functioning cognitive faculties under the right conditions. And so long as it's properly grounded and defended from known objections, it is rational and justified.
Are they talking there, Dr. Pagan, about what we might refer to in theological circles as natural knowledge of God?
Absolutely.
So on two fronts, both kind of in the sense of what we can't deny or what we can't not know, and in the face of various arguments, it is the belief in God is a rational enterprise, if all we're talking about is simply belief in a God.
That's correct, yes.
Let's talk a little bit about the atheists that define themselves by not believing in God. They often claim both the intellectual and the rational high ground. How do you respond to that?
Well, that position is, I think, most prominently exemplified with the New Atheism. The New Atheism is an intellectual movement promoted by a cadre of non-theist scholars who are overtly, if you will, missional in their efforts to propagate the view that religion should not be tolerated, but rather should be criticized as irrational wherever its influence arises. The New Atheists openly deride religion as an outmoded and evidentially void impediment to human flourishing and societal progress. For instance, in his book, The God Delusion, Richard Dawkins proposes that religious belief is, and I quote, an accidental byproduct or a misfiring of something useful. He's also said that he's against religion because it teaches us to be satisfied with not understanding the world. And upon this conviction, Dawkins has made it his mission to, if you will, evangelize the world with a gospel of scientific naturalism, a worldview that holds that the empirical methods of scientific investigation are the only way of gaining true knowledge about the world. This movement is also commonly associated with other individuals such as Daniel Dennett, who is a professional philosopher, Sam Harris, who is a neuroscientist, the late Christopher Hitchens, and Victor Stenger, who is a physicist.
So what makes these, as you say, kind of evangelistic, missional atheist. How are they different from the crop of atheists that were more quietistic, that certainly would write, certainly would occasionally engage in debate, but they didn't proselytize as much? What makes them different?
I would say one of the most defining characteristics of a new atheistic movement is its vitriolic disposition. Again, they are openly evangelistic, they are aggressive at times, and they're not satisfied with remaining within the discourse of, say, the secular academia and talking about these issues there. They do have a very clear public presence, and they're committed to their mission to propagate their ideas.
Is their aim evenly spread, as far as you can see from their writings, evenly spread across all religions, all claims of some sort of divine transcendence, or do they tend to single out Christianity?
I think the Abrahamic monotheistic traditions have been singled out and targeted with the most criticism from this group.
Why is that, you think?
Many of them would identify Abrahamic monotheism with being responsible for, say, civil atrocities, impediments to scientific progress, and so forth, as opposed to, as Sam Harris has discussed, certain forms of Buddhism, which are essentially non-theistic forms of psychological wellness.
Do they seem to engage Christianity as it is, or do they engage caricatures of Christianity?
I think they do often engage caricatures of Christianity. Many of them fail to understand the most rudimentary theological and philosophical concepts, and it is a straw man argument that is often made when criticizing or attempting to undermine the essential truth claims of the Christian worldview.
An exception to that, at least from my observation, is the late Christopher Hitchens, who seemed to know very well what the central claims of Christianity were, but he simply repudiated them. Would you agree?
He did so, but without acknowledging also that successful rebuttals and refutations of his criticisms have been offered by Christian apologists and Christian philosophers.
So provide us with a few examples, if you could, of the atheists' arguments that they mount against the existence of God.
Okay. Well, I think there are about two different broad categories here. I would call them two categories of atheological or atheistic arguments. Firstly, there are logical arguments, which are designed to prove the concept of God as self-contradictory or logically inconsistent with some known fact. For instance, some have attempted to show that certain divine attributes, such as God's freedom and his foreknowledge, are incompatible with one another. Secondly, there are evidential arguments, which are constructed to demonstrate that certain known facts provide evidence against the existence of God. Examples of such evidential arguments would be the so-called problem of gratuitous evil and suffering, the explanatory power of biological evolution by natural selection, the observation of religious diversity, the hiddenness of God, and of course, the psychological origin of religious belief. Now, certainly the most formidable of such arguments has been the argument from evil. William Lane Craig has said that undoubtedly this is the single greatest intellectual obstacle to belief in God. John Stott wrote, "The fact of suffering may constitute the single greatest challenge to the Christian faith." And John Feinberg remarked, "Probe an atheist or agnostic deeply enough about why they doubt God's existence, and he or she will likely recount for you the problem of evil. This problem keeps many from faith in God altogether and rattles the faith of even the staunchest believers."
Is there a good and simple response to the most formidable of their arguments, the problem of gratuitous evil?
Well, you'd really be giving a 50-cent response to a $1 million question there. And the best responses are what I would call empirically adequate, logically coherent, and existentially relevant. Now, the so-called intellectual problem of evil and suffering certainly has been solved. However, what's called the emotional, or sometimes identified with the evidential problem of evil and suffering, is still very much so a problem for many. However, this problem is really within the province of the pastoral counselor rather than the Christian philosopher or apologist.
On whom does the burden of proof lie in the debate over the existence of God?
Another great question. the burden of proof is the obligation on a party in what's called an epistemic dispute or a dispute about knowledge claims to provide sufficient justification for their position. Now, in philosophical discourse, there is an implicit burden of proof on the person asserting a claim. Thus, in the ongoing debate on God's existence, the burden of proof would lie with the non-theist if he asserts God's non-existence.
So let's talk about an argument that you deal with in the course of your chapter in the book, Making the Case for Christianity, the Kalam cosmological argument. What is it?
The Kalam is named for the Kalam tradition of Islamic discursive philosophy in which it was originally formulated. The Kalam is really a variation of the classic argument for God's existence from the first cause of the universe. It's a linear form of the cosmological argument that could be syllogized as follows. All things that begin to exist have a cause. Now, this major premise expresses the principle of causality, which functions as a foundational presupposition of scientific investigation. And it's noteworthy that this principle is religiously neutral and has never been falsified. The minor premise, the universe began to exist, is a religiously neutral, scientifically verified, and philosophically consistent claim that has been repeatedly proven by scientific evidence, such as the second law of thermodynamics, the universe expansion, radiation afterglow, galaxy seeds, and Einstein's theory of relativity. Finally, there's the conclusion. Therefore, the universe has a cause. Now, if the major and minor premises are true, and the logical inferences are valid, then the conclusion is a true proposition that is entailed by the argument. Because space, time, and matter were brought into being out of nothing by this cause, the cause itself must have been spaceless, timeless, and immaterial. Moreover, the cause must have been able to freely choose to create the universe, since a mechanically operating set of necessary and sufficient conditions could not account for the genesis of the universe. The best explanation for such a spaceless, timeless, immaterial, and existentially free being is the God of Christian theism.
We're talking with Dr. Joshua Pagan about the existence of God on this Monday afternoon, June the 2nd. When we come back, sounds a little bit like the arguments employed by intelligent design, but there are differences. We'll find out what they are right after this.
You know you want to be there. A pile of pastors, a mountain of musicians, a boatload of laity, all passionate about worship, gathered together on the beautiful campus of Concordia University, Nebraska, this coming July, the 28th through the 31st. Comfort, comfort ye my people, preaching, praying, and singing the comfort of Christ to the troubled conscience and the broken heart. John Kleinick, Paul Solek, Betsy Werner, Brian Wolfmiller, Robin Lever, and the stash himself, President Matthew Harrison. Oh yeah, and two other guys named Wilkin and Whedon, along with a whole pile of your favorite Issues Etc. guests. Did I mention that the registration cost starts at just $175, or that full-time students, including seminarians and deaconess students, pay just $25 registration? Yeah, seriously. I told you, you want to be there. For more information, click the link, Comfort Comfort, on the Issues Etc. homepage, issuesetc.org.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers, you're listening to Issues Etc.
If your travels bring you to Northwest Indiana, the Saints of Heritage Lutheran Church in Valparaiso invite you to join us for a Christ-centered, cross-focused divine service at 9 a.m. on Sunday morning. For more information about visiting Heritage, please contact Pastor Joseph Ostafinski by calling 219-464-2810 or sending an email to heritagelc@frontier.com. You can also visit us on the web at www.heritage-lcms.org.
Imagine steadfastlutherans.org as the internet version of your neighborhood pub. Your neighborhood confessional Lutheran pub, that is, where the finest in Lutheran conversation is going on at every table and at the bar, sometimes contentious, but always informative and unabashedly Lutheran. We're only serving Wittenberg Ale. We even have a guy named Norm, so check us out. www.steadfastlutherans.org. We'll save a seat at the bar for you.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. On this Monday afternoon, we're talking about the existence of God. Dr. Joshua Pagan is our guest. Before the break, Dr. Pagan, you were talking about the Kalam cosmological argument, and many of our listeners might have noticed some similarities with the argument of intelligent design, basically that complexity implies design and design a designer. The universe is, well, the biggest complex of complexity there is. Therefore, we have good evidence in the design or the designedness looking of the universe that there is a designer. What are your thoughts there?
Absolutely. Well, now you'd be making reference to a separate argument, which is oftentimes called the argument from design or the teleological argument. What the Kalam essentially aims to do is to demonstrate that a being such as God, being ontologically infinite in nature, is the best explanation for the created and finite nature of the universe. So rather than positing God as the best explanation for the fine-tuning of the universe or the initial conditions necessary to the universe that we currently observe, the Kalam asserts that God is the best explanation of the cause of the universe.
So someone might ask, why is it reasonable to posit a divine first cause rather than a natural first cause?
Well, simply put, it's both reasonable and necessary to posit an infinite and divine first cause as the best explanation of the finite and material nature of the universe, because the most recent research in cosmology has established that prior to the Big Bang, there was no natural state of affairs, and therefore, a natural cause is simply not possible. Prior to the late modern era, atheists felt no compulsion to embrace the view that the cosmos came into existence ex nihilo, or out of nothing, and therefore required a creator. When the timeless question of cosmic origins was posed, the non-theists could simply respond by proposing that the universe is itself eternal. It is a brute fact that always was and always will be, as Carl Sagan suggested. Such an explanation regards the cosmos as a sort of factual necessity. In other words, it's not possible that our universe could have ever been non-existent. This was the view of many ancient philosophers and was famously suggested also by the 18th century skeptical empiricist David Hume, who asked, why may not the material universe be the necessary existent being? The answer to Hume's question lies in the modern discovery that the universe almost certainly has a contingent rather than necessary nature. The overwhelming evidence of 20th century astrophysical investigation has given way to a revolutionary paradigm shift. Within the scientific community, it is now widely accepted that the cosmos began to exist in the finite past in an explosive event commonly termed the Big Bang. When the preponderance of scientific data is considered, those who would echo Hume's question are now forced to grapple with the idea that space, time, and cosmic matter came into existence as contingent realities that require a cause. If this ultimate cause is to explain the observed evidence and avoid logical incoherencies, it must be a metaphysically necessary, timeless, and personal cause. In light of these attributes, the best explanation is that such a cause is an entity not at all unlike what Christians call God.
What if someone says, and it often is said at this particular point in the conversation, well, why can't I say what caused God? Isn't that kind of a, you've certainly heard it. Well, if God caused everything, what caused God?
Absolutely. The major premise of the Kalam cosmological argument states, all things that begin to exist have a cause. Now, God, being ontologically necessary and infinite in nature, did not begin to exist. He always was, always is, and always will be. Therefore, God does not require a cause. That question then, of course, misunderstands that the nature of God and conflates him with the contingent or created realities of the universe, which did in fact begin to exist a finite time ago. I hope that makes sense.
Well, I guess I wonder, have the skeptics or the forces of atheism, have they attempted to mount a response to the Kalam cosmological argument?
Absolutely. In response to what I just stated, in fact, some have said that this is special pleading for God. that God is the one thing that does not require a first cause because he didn't begin to exist. But in fact, it's not. Actually, the idea of an infinite thing being the best explanation for the universe was really what atheists asserted a long time ago prior to the confirmation of Big Bang cosmology. They said that the universe doesn't require an explanation because it is infinite in nature. Christians have said, now that we know that the universe is finite in nature, it does require an infinite first cause. Apart from that, it leads to the problem of infinite regress.
I've read in casually in cosmology, kind of popularization of cosmology books, and often what is suggested, it's not argued for or proven, it's simply told by way of storytelling, is that before the Big Bang, some condition of nothingness, which has some kind of potential to it, exists eternally, and it is out of that, and they will say, out of that nothingness, the potential of nothing, that the universe sprang. Are they simply substituting nothing for where God would more logically fit?
Absolutely, absolutely. The problem is that that thinking commits really a category mistake insofar as it assigns properties to nothing, the complete absence of a state of affairs that do belong to something, which is a state of affairs. Truly nothing has no potency, or as you said, potential, to bring about any given state of affairs at all. It is nothing. Therefore, there's no way that nothing could have brought about something. In fact, this stands in direct violation as a metaphysical first principle to the principle of causality. Ex nihilo nihil fit. Out of nothing, nothing comes. This is, again, the foundation of scientific inquiry, and it's a presupposition which is necessary to rational discourse. So the idea that absolutely nothing suddenly produced something, especially something as particular as the universe, and mathematically improbable as the universe, given its, as you said before, fine-tuned nature, is absolutely ridiculous. As William Craig has suggested before, at least with magic, you have a hat and a magician in order to produce a rabbit. Now we're asked to believe that there's no magician or no hat, just nothing produced something.
Which is worse than
magic, of course, and requires a bit more faith.
have you found among perhaps the more scientifically inclined skeptics a willingness to admit that they have run up against this problem and that the Kalam cosmological argument has merit, although I'm sure that they would say, give us enough time and we'll figure a way around it. But have you found a few honest men lurking among the skeptics?
Indeed, this is the case. Some have said before that it's intellectually irresponsible to posit God for what we don't know. And they'll refer to this as the God of the gaps mistake. The theists are, again, trying to call upon God as the best explanation for the gaps in our knowledge. This fails to understand, however, that we are really positing God not as the best explanation for what we don't know, but rather for what we do know. For instance, Lennox has said before that, I'm not positing God to explain what I don't know. He's not the God of the gaps. He's the God of the whole show.
We'll take a break, and when we come back in the second hour of the program, more on the existence of God with Dr. Joshua Pagan, founding director of the Institute for Intellectual Formation and Skeptical Inquiry and author of a chapter in the book Making the Case for Christianity. His chapter is titled Defending the Existence of God. When we come back, is the existence of God the same thing as Christianity? It's the kind of thing that you run up against, your kids will run up against, your grandkids when they go off to college and university. They need help answering some of these arguments. They need something, good equipment in their intellectual toolbox to be able to respond to those who say, look, there is no God and there's no rational argument for the existence of God. That's what LCMSU is for. Connecting with solid Lutheran congregations and solid Lutheran resources. Find out more at lcms.org/LCMSU, lcms.org/LCMSU. We'll talk more about the existence of God with Dr. Joshua Pagan after this.
Solid, serious, substantive. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
When you need a friend, you have a friend in Jesus Christ, the Good Shepherd, and friends among his people at Good Shepherd Lutheran Church, Arnold, Missouri. At Good Shepherd Lutheran Church, we offer Christ-centered word and sacrament ministry, inspirational liturgical worship services, and faithful preaching and teaching. Sunday worship services are at 9 a.m. Sunday school and Bible class are at 10:30. We also have an excellent Christian preschool. We invite you to join us. Good Shepherd Lutheran Church, 2211 Tenbrook Road, Arnold, Missouri, 636-296-1292.
What happens when our theology is driven by freshness instead of faithfulness? I've written an article for the Latest Issues, Etc. journal titled New Thing Theology. You can read it by subscribing to the online Issues, Etc. journal. Just look for the red subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. The Wittenberg Trail feature details how Bob Leeko journeyed from the Word Faith movement to faith in Christ alone. The free online Issues, Etc. journal.
You don't have to be dogmatic to reject that Zeus or Apollo or any of the other dead gods. I mean, we all reject these gods. We don't have to prove their absence. I mean, this is one of the fallacies of religious argumentation, the idea that the atheist has to prove the absence of God. Nobody's proved the absence of Zeus. And yet everyone's behaving as though the God of Abraham has a completely different status than these thousands of other dead gods. And he frankly doesn't.
That's atheist Sam Harris making his assertion from the atheist side. The burden of proof does not lie with the atheist in proving the non-existence of God, but rather with the theist, or perhaps even in his case, he's talking about the Christian, for the existence of their God. We're talking about the existence of God. Dr. Joshua Pagan is our guest for the next few minutes of the program on this Monday afternoon. Then Pastor Tom Baker joins us. We'll be teaching a Sunday school lesson, The Children of Israel Cross the Red Sea, Exodus chapter 14, in just a few minutes here on Issues, Etc. Dr. Pagan, let's make a distinction if we can. Is the existence of God the same thing as historic Christianity?
Well, I would say no. And the phrase, the existence of God, it's associated with the worldview of theism, which is really a broad worldview category that encompasses a number of conceptions of God. Examples would include deism, finite godism, pantheism, and panentheism. Christian theism, however, describes a very particular vision of God. That is to say, in Orthodox Christian theology, God is described as having the ontological attributes of omniscience, he's all-knowing, omnipotence, he's all-powerful, and omnibenevolence, he is all-loving. Moreover, the God of biblical description is an infinite being who is distinct from the created world as the creator of that world.
So theism certainly comes in as an ally of historic Christianity, but should not be confused with historic Christianity?
Absolutely. That's correct. That's correct.
I guess this leads me to wonder, is atheism, while it claims the rational high ground, actually irrational when it comes to its major assertion, that is, the non-existence of God?
On my assessment, the atheist who holds his view in the absence of sound arguments, evidence, or other grounds is in fact an irrational believer. Now, speaking of atheism and irrationality, it shouldn't go unmentioned that it's been cogently argued that if the story of evolutionary naturalism is true, then our noetic equipment, or belief-producing cognitive faculties, have evolved to achieve survival and reproductive success, not knowledge of true states of affairs. In other words, if the atheist is correct in his worldview, our brains are the result of the unguided, irrational processes of natural selection by random mutation, and thus, we really have no good reason to believe that the products of our brains, our thoughts, our theories, or whatever it may be, are rational and reliable.
That would pretty much undo science, philosophy, every intellectual enterprise, wouldn't it?
Indeed, it would.
So it sounds like what you're arguing for there is, if saying in essence to the naturalist skeptic, if you're right, you can't know you're right.
That's correct. You certainly couldn't know with what's called incorrigible epistemic certitude, which is the idea that you absolutely cannot be wrong. But it could be argued from the story of evolutionary naturalism that we couldn't even know with a high degree of certainty about what the contents of our consciousness were, or about the theories, such as the theory of biological evolution by natural selection, that's been produced by our cognitive faculties. Again, they've evolved for the sake of survival and reproductive success, not obtaining true knowledge about the world. So, if evolution is true, it might be argued that evolution is false, or at the very least, an unreliable theory.
Finally, then, how would you describe the relationship between a kind of theism that would be the result of the Kalam cosmological argument, the argument from a first cause, and historic Christianity? How would you describe the relationship between those two things?
Well, formal arguments and evidence can get a person only so far as theism, a God who is distinct from the world, as the best explanation of the contingent nature of reality or even the design of reality. You could even argue with the axiological or the moral argument that God is the best explanation of our moral consciousness and of the observation of moral absolutes in the world. However, Christianity makes a very particular set of truth claims about the nature of God and his interaction with the course of human affairs. It says that God became incarnate in order to not only communicate with mankind about who he is and his redemptive plan for humanity, but rather he participated in our sufferings and vicariously satisfied the wrath of God on our behalf. Now, that's a particular claim, the story of Christian incarnation and soteriology and so forth, which is separate from more generalized brands of theism and very distinct from something such as finite godism, the idea that God is finite and limited in his attributes, or deism, the idea that God is separate from the universe and not involved in the course of human affairs. So again, in Christianity, we have something which goes far beyond the broad claim of theism, that there is such a being as God. What we claim in Christianity is that God has revealed himself in a very particular way, that he is one divine being comprised of three different centers of consciousness or persons, that they are all equally divine, and that the second person of the Trinity died 2,000 years ago in order to redeem humanity who couldn't redeem itself.
Dr. Joshua Pagan is founding director of the Institute for Intellectual Formation and Skeptical Inquiry, and he's author of a chapter in the book Making the Case for Christianity. His chapter is titled Defending the Existence of God. Dr. Pagan, thank you very much for being our guest.
Thank you. I appreciate your time.